Following program has been brought to you by Barterhouse Wines. For more information, visit www.thebarterhouse.com.
Well, I think part of the sourcing process to me is the most exciting, because you know, you rent a car and you drive through the south of France, and you know, you obviously have some appointments set up, but you know, some of the most exciting things happen when you're just kind of winging it. And you meet a farmer at, you know, a wine fair, and he says, well, come back to my estate, and you're not quite sure where you're going, and you follow a guy in a Peugeot, you know, up a rambling hill, and all of a sudden you come across either a castle or like a shack in the woods, and the guy's making wine out of the back of his, you know, house, or he could be making wine out of a major estate. You know, looks are deceiving, but you want to assume that someone with a very established chateau is making good wine. But 9 times out of 10, the guy out of the garage who's like super passionate is making these better wines, and they're maybe more rustic and less polished. So to me, like the restaurateur, the sommelier, this story resonates with them about the small farmer, you know, the guy who's making wine on small quantities, 80 cases, 100 cases. Those are the things exciting to Barterhouse, and hopefully the things exciting to our clients.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, back on the air. This is our second show on the Everglades and the Florida ecosystem. And you hear that great music in the background that Jack is playing, because if you were camping now in the Everglades and you woke up in the morning, you'd hear the great calls of the birds. And the same goes at sunset when the birds go back to roost. You have great bird calls. So my guests today, again, are Ariana Ricard and her husband Pierre Ricard. And the first show we spoke a little bit about the Everglades system, and Pierre spoke about his lobbying that he's working on now. In fact, he's going to have to leave soon to go to Albany to lobby for solar energy bill. Is that right, Pierre? So say hi, guys.
That's correct.
Hello. Hello.
Okay, so we're going to continue from last week's show, and we're going to talk now about we're going to talk about your canoe trip. Is that what we're going to have next?
Yeah, I thought, though, I would explain the map that we posted on the website. So
sure.
Pierre took a picture of one of the map of the Everglades, and I put some symbols on there. So we circled Shark Valley, and that's where the great bike trail is. And then I put a birder near the Anhinga Trail, and that's right near the Ernest Cove Visitor Center, like that first eastern entrance to the park. And if you don't have that much time in the Everglades, definitely go to Anhinga Trail. It's only like a half a mile boardwalk loop, and you'll see lots of wildlife there, anhingas and gators. And then down further into the park, I put a mark for where we camped at Flamingo, and also where the good birding is at Eagle Pond, and then at 9 Mile Pond, which is where we went canoeing. And to mark that, I put a mini tornado.
Oh, that's what that is. Okay.
Mini tornado, because we got hit by a storm when we went canoeing. But that day was a series of mishaps. That was our Thursday, Pierre's full day in the Everglades. So it started off, we got there Wednesday night, and we were camping at Flamingo, and I knew that vultures were a problem in the campground. Raccoons used to be a problem, but I guess with the last hurricane, it wiped out a lot of the raccoon population. So now you have to watch out for vultures. And if you leave anything out, the vultures will get it. They'll come right up to your picnic table. So the night before, we had put all the food in the car and in the tents, but we had left our 5-gallon jug of water on the table. And I thought, well, the vultures aren't going to go after the water. They're not going to mess with that. But we had also accidentally left an open chip bag, and it had spilled chips on the ground, and we had thrown out the chip bag, but the chips were still there. So Thursday morning, we wake up, and I hear rustling around our tent, and I look out the window, and there were vultures around the tent and all over the picnic table, and they had eaten all the chips, and they had poked holes in the water. So the water was leaking, and we were going to have to go buy some more water. But the vultures, we saw both turkey vultures and black vultures, and I find them to be fascinating creatures.
Well, if you look at them, only a mother vulture could really love a vulture. They're pretty ugly birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
With that naked head. But when they fly, they're beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The soaring and the flights and, you know. And so tell us about the vulture, the lifestyle. And why do they have a naked head? Why no feathers on the head, right?
So, yeah. So they have the naked, bald head because they are sticking their heads into carrion and into dead carcasses. And when they're pulling their head out, they don't want these dead pieces of flesh sticking to their feathers, because then the bacteria attached to those would also be on the vulture. So it's a matter of hygiene that they have this bald head.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So there's the black vultures and the turkey vultures. And the black vultures find carrion more by sight, and the turkey vultures find it by smell. So the part of the brain that processes smell in the turkey vulture is larger than in any other type of bird. And they can fly low to the ground, so they can pick up the scent of dead animals.
And they can pick up the scent from high up, too.
Mm-hmm.
On those nice warm days when they fly to thermals, you know, the air currents that are rising, they can pick up the scent from maybe a mile below, half a mile.
Yeah, they can find a dead animal below the forest canopy. Mm-hmm. You can't even see it, but they can smell it.
They can find it, right.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to identify them while they're flying is their wings, right? Talk about the dihedral.
Yeah, well, the turkey vulture has got two-tone wings, so if you see it flying overhead, it's sort of like a V-shape, an upward V-shape while they're soaring overhead.
Mm-hmm. And the black vulture has a different flight
pattern. Yeah, I think it's all black.
It's all black, and they fly with their wings straight out, so there's no V in the wing, right? I think it's called dihedral, which is the scientific word for the V, okay? So that's the way you can spot them. If you're a birder, or even if you're not a birder and you're just curious, you look up in the sky, see these big black birds circling around, watching you to see if you're still alive. No, they're no threat. Just as you say, they're pests in the picnic
Yeah, areas. And there are signs up that say that they will attack rubber on cars, so they will destroy windshield wipers and things like that.
Yeah.
But there are some other interesting things about vultures that I learned, that they will defecate on their legs.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. And the water and the feces will evaporate, and it cools down their legs. But also, some people think it might be an antiseptic, that the digestive juices will kill off bacteria, and so that will protect their legs when they poop.
That's a good excuse for peeing on your legs.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. if you told your mother, well, I'm doing that because it's antiseptic, I don't know. Right.
And then I also learned their self-defense mechanism is to vomit on anything that is harassing them. It keeps the predators away. And they can send their vomit saline 10 feet. And
really?
Even the turkey vulture babies will do this. They will vomit on anyone's harassing them. And it does keep the predators away.
I guess so. That's pretty effective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I've never seen that.
No, we didn't see that either.
Yeah. So they're a presence all over the park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's plenty of dead stuff for them to eat.
Yeah.
Right? Roadkill and just natural deaths. And, you know, and if a predator eats something and leaves some over, they'll come down right away and clean up. They're the cleanup squads.
Yes.
Right? They clean
right.
Keep the forest clean. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's one thing. So tell me now, what happened on this canoe trip?
So then after we went to the marina and bought some more water, we rented out a canoe. So we went over to Nine Mile Pond, which is a nice trail. Peter, you want to talk about that?
Sure. So we got the canoe and set off kind of, I guess it was late morning.
Mm-hmm.
When we had
Were you with a ranger or on your own?
On our own.
Okay, so it was an easy trail to follow, just get to the other end and come back?
Well, I would say without the sticks marking where you were going, it would have been very difficult otherwise.
Okay.
But the well-signed along the mangroves.
The markers, yeah.
Yeah, the markers. And it was really a fascinating canoe trip. You know, they take you the landing areas, kind of an open water area, which is on our way back where we ran into the storm. But as soon as you go into the mangrove, you're kind of covered by the forest, and it's a really sort of mysterious kind of what's around each next corner.
You never know.
That's right. That's right.
And we had picked Nine Mile Pond because one of the rangers had recommended it to us, and another ranger told us that there was a gigantic crocodile living there. I think he said it was like 13 feet, as big as a whale. And I wanted to see this giant crocodile.
Almost as big as your canoe.
Yeah.
That's right.
I didn't want it to be really close to us, but I still wanted to get a look at it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they don't really bother you.
No,
they're not very aggressive.
Yeah.
And by now they're used to people, so.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So we had seen the mangrove, of course, forest and the sort of sawgrass areas, and also got a glimpse of many epiphytic plants.
Tell people what those are. Some people don't know what epiphytes are.
Sure. Well, they're plants that grow basically on other plants, and they don't actually root into the soil on the ground, but in fact are up high on the branches of other plants, and kind of often sort of most often you'll see a species such as Spanish moss in the south. It's kind of being
right.
Very typical.
And the other ones, the bromeliads.
Bromeliads, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Were any of them flowering? They have these beautiful flowers.
Yeah.
Some of them
yeah.
look like pineapple mm-hmm. plants growing mm-hmm. on there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. you know, they're home to tree frogs.
Mm-hmm.
The tree frogs will lay their eggs in the water that gets caught in the bromeliads and live their whole life cycle, you know, on the tree. They'll never come down because they'll mate and they'll drop their eggs in the water in the bromeliads, and the hatchlings, you know, the tadpoles come out and they grow up and then they're on the trees. Mm-hmm. So they're really interesting plants. And there are a lot of varieties of the bromeliads, and you could buy them in, you know, and raise them at home, right? Bromeliads, you can buy them in a not a local florist. Well, maybe in a local, mm-hmm. I don't think so, but in these plant dealers.
Sure.
Yeah, especially in Florida, there's plant dealers all along that mm-hmm. road leading from, were you on that road leading from Penny Camp up to the park?
Yeah, I think that was Route 1 maybe.
Yeah,
or something.
You see all those plant businesses mm-hmm. there. And do you remember that book, The Orchid Thief?
Oh, we never read it, but I do remember it.
Yes, it's mm-hmm. about this woman who was investigating orchids in the Everglades, and she hired this guy to guide her around, and he was a real local character. And because there is a business of poaching orchids from the park and around the areas, and there's this one orchid, I think it's called a ghost orchid, which is a beautiful white orchid that's very hard to find, and this guy knew where to find these orchids. So that's an interesting story too, and they made a movie out of it, which didn't really have much to do with the park.
Adaptation, right?
An adaptation.
Yeah,
good,
adaptation.
Jack. You're right. Did you see it, Jack?
Yeah. I did, yeah. It didn't have too much to do with the
no.
with the orchids.
Right. But the original book was pretty good. I think Susan Orleans wrote it, if I remember correctly. But I don't really remember. It was years ago. So anyhow, what happened when the storm came?
Well, before the storm hit,
okay.
we did see the crocodile. It wasn't that close to us, but we saw it swimming by.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were just about back to where we were going to dock the canoes, but we still had all this open water to cross.
Yeah, that's right. So earlier I was kind of showing off and, you know, paddling really hard and just having fun with that. And it was a good thing I did that in the end, because the storm really came up quickly, as they kind of typically do, I guess, in sort of tropical environment. And within probably 20 minutes of us seeing some storm clouds off in the distance, it was right near overhead.
And, yeah, so we saw the tops of the trees start to sway, and we saw these dark, menacing clouds coming towards us. And then we saw a water spout right where we were going to put the canoes.
Really? A water spout,
Yeah, a little mini tornado on the water.
Right.
And I looked at Pierre and I said, that's going to hit us. And then I got a little bit scared.
Yeah, so this little wind eddy, it sort of spun right across the water, probably maybe 30 yards in front of us, and of course we're in the open water section just about to dock, so we're paddling as hard as we can, and you know, 40 mile per hour wind gusts, and had tipped our canoe sideways, but we had luckily counterbalanced just in time before the water came in.
All right.
Yeah, so we were like, first we were pointing towards the dock, and then the wind hit us so that we were then parallel to the shore, and then we got ourselves going in the correct direction, and then it hit us again, and Pierre dropped the paddle and held both sides of the canoe. After we did take on some water, but he kept it from tipping, and I wasn't worried that we were going to die or the crocodile was going to eat us, but we both had our expensive cameras in the canoe, and if we had tipped over, then those would have been destroyed.
Right, sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Cameras don't do well in water.
No, they don't. Not even when they're in Ziploc bags.
Yeah, right. So you survived it, and you got back to your campsite, and what was at your campsite? Was it okay or what?
Well, our campsite, many of the tents actually had gotten hit by the wind as well, and including our tent, which we had unfortunately, one of the poles had snapped near the bottom.
Wow.
From the gust of wind, but folks did at least clean up and But it did actually continue raining through the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, so we rushed back to the campsite, and my friend Trent Blair had decided to skip the canoeing to study. And so I yelled, "Are you there, Trent?" And he had taken cover in his tent, and he hadn't even noticed our tent getting destroyed. And so we just had to take cover with him for about 2 or 3 hours while this storm just... It was just torrential rain. Mm. It was so windy. And lightning, too, I think, right?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And our stuff got wet.
But you survived.
But we survived.
And you have a great story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And you have pictures of the broken tent, right? You showed me a picture, right? Yeah. Okay. You can save that to show to your children. Your
yes.
Adventures in the Everglades.
Yes.
Right?
Invest in a better tent before you go to the Everglades.
Right. Okay, so we have 2 minutes left in this first half of the show. So after you were you camped in Flamingo, how many nights were you in Flamingo?
So when I came down with Trent before Pierre got there, we were there Saturday night and Sunday night. And then when Pierre came into town, we were there Wednesday and Thursday night. Mm-hmm. So 4 nights total.
Right. Okay, so I think what we could do, we have about 20 minutes left. We'll take a break in a minute or two, and then when we come back, maybe you talk some more about the critters that you haven't spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because there's so many things to talk about there. It's such a great ecosystem that we'll come back with the second half of the show with Ariana and Pierre, and we'll be back down in the Everglades after the storm.
A nice young man, not the kind to kill, but a jealous pilot and a flashing blade. Sent him on a run through the Everglades, running like a dog through the Everglades.
Now the posse went in and they came back out. They said he'll die and there ain't no doubt. It's an eye for an eye, so the debt is paid. It won't last long in the Everglades.
A man can't live in the Everglades, where a man can hide and never be found, and have no fear of the baying hound. But he better keep a moving and don't stand still. If the skeeters don't get him, then the gators will.
Now the years went by and his girl was wed.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Speakeasy every Wednesday at 3 p.m., where host Damon Volte will discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe, with guests ranging from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, and every expert and enthusiast in between. Learn from some of the world's leading experts in mixology, bar history, distillation, and brewing about how we enjoy imbibing today. Again, that's every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with the last segment of this show on the Everglades with my two great guests, Ariana and Pierre, who just told me how they survived this canoe trip on the open ocean. Actually, it was on a pond, right? A long, narrow pond.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
9 mile pond.
9 mile
yeah.
pond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you got back okay and you dried off by the next day,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then was that the end of the trip?
Well, then we made another bad decision to go hiking after the rainstorm.
Okay.
So then
who was waiting for you?
So we went to Snake Bite Trail.
Yeah.
And as soon as we stepped onto the trail, the mosquitoes swarmed us. And they love Pierre's blood.
Oh, yeah.
They were after
rich blood?
Him. That's yeah, I
blood.
Guess so. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the salt marsh mosquitoes that were attacking
us. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
They are nasty little critters.
They are nasty. And I had the insect repellent, and I was spraying Pierre as quickly as I could. But even as I was spraying his hand, there was 3 on his hand, and they were biting his palms. They were biting his lips. Mm. They were biting his face. Yeah. Yeah, he had a lot of bites when we came back.
Yeah, so if you go to the Everglades, you have to expect mosquitoes. But if you go in the middle of the winter, January, February, March, it's pretty good. But if you are in the underbrush, you were walking in the trail, and right?
Right.
And there were trees on both sides and all that. That's where the mosquitoes lurk. They don't like bright sunshine. They're always like, they like the shade, I think, more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no breeze blowing, then you have a problem.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And so I read a little bit about the mosquitoes, and it's not the males that are biting, it's the females. So both the males and the females feed on plant juices, but the females need a blood meal.
Those females are always the dangerous of the species, right?
Yeah. No. Though Pierre does say that after all these mishaps, I'm not allowed to plan our vacations anymore.
Okay.
And then I also learned that the reason you get a bite after the mosquito attacks you is that it squirts its saliva into the wound, and that causes the irritation. But the larva mosquito is an important food for many juvenile fishes.
Yep.
And then there was a sign in one of the visitor centers that says, if you get bit by a mosquito, congratulations, you're now a part of the Florida ecosystem. So your blood is nourishing the mosquitoes and everything that eats the mosquitoes.
Right. The female needs the blood
to produce the eggs.
Produce the eggs. So you're really, you know, you have offspring there already. Mm-hmm. You're part owners of that.
Yeah, we've left a part of ourselves.
You have an investment.
Yes.
See that? That's great. So that's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. So the mosquitoes are really, the larvae especially, are food for fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, little small fish, you know, part of the food chain in the glades.
And I think frogs too.
Yeah, frogs eat mosquitoes and lizards. And
bats.
And bats, yeah. Everybody eats them except us. Maybe we should have some recipes for mosquitoes.
Yeah, maybe.
Sauteed mosquitoes with onions and garlic. No. Mm-hmm. Well, whatever. Okay, so is there another favorite critter you want to talk about? Then I'll end the show with talking about, when Jack was playing this music, about the desperados in the Everglades. So pick out.
Okay, so, well, when we did, we did see some great blue herons on the Anhinga Trail, and one interesting thing about them is that they have these four-toed feet, and the feet act like snowshoes, and they help distribute their weight so that the great blue heron doesn't sink into the mud. And you can get great pictures of them because they stand very, very still waiting for a fish to swim by so they can spear it.
A lot of patience, just standing still waiting, right?
Mm-hmm. And then also we saw some roseate spoonbills, and they are just beautiful, beautiful birds. They're got this pink wings, and they have these red stripes on their shoulders. I think an orange tail and a green head and red eyes. And they have this big spoon-shaped bill, and they feed by moving the bill back and forth in the murky bottoms. And they feed actually by touch, by tactile location. So as soon as they feel something hit the bill, then they will close their bill, and that's how they catch their food.
Yeah, and you have pictures of these guys on the website, right, on our show. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think also their pink color is from what they eat.
Yeah, they eat like shrimp. Mm-hmm, just like the flamingo.
Yeah, like flamingos. And they get the pigments into their feathers, and that gives them their beautiful pink color.
And then another bird that feeds by tactile location is the wood stork.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And it actually has the fastest reflex known for a vertebrate species. When its bill touches a prey item, it'll snap shut in 25 milliseconds.
Yeah, very fast. They're also kind of ugly-looking birds.
Yeah.
The same thing, only a mother could love those critters. They're big, gawky-looking birds, and they nest up on trees, on branches.
Mm-hmm.
They look ridiculous up there.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're flying, they're really fantastic, beautiful flyers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's really two seasons in the Everglades, the wet season and the dry season. And most of the animals give birth, I think, right at the end of the wet season. I don't remember. Do you know, Ariane, when they is the breeding season? Yeah, it's in the wintertime, our winter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because what happens is, as you go towards springtime, there's less and less rain in spite of your thunderstorm. You know, the rainy season's over there, and what happens is that the water level goes down, and all the critters that live in the water get bunched together, and it's easy picking for all these birds, the long-legged waders. And the gator is called the keeper of the glades, because what the alligators do, they make these alligator holes around their nest. They'll clear an area and dig it out, actually, so the water will form a little pool there. So all the critters, the fish and all those critters, are going to hang out there. And all he has to do is step out of his door, practically, and he can get a meal. So I think the native folks called them the keeper of the glades
because
they kept all this water bodies open. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so what else we have here?
Well, you mentioned the brown pelican in your show about Belize, and you were talking about how they dive headfirst into the water, and I learned that they have special air sacs beneath their chest to cushion the impact for when they hit that water.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And these are 8-pound birds, but every day they eat 4 pounds of fish.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
And you know, birds have hollow bones that makes them much lighter than they look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, an adaptation for flying and also for storing. Some critters have hollow bones, I think. It's not the manatees. Which one that I was reading about? So they can store oxygen. Like the manatees. The manatees' lungs run across the whole top of their body. So they have huge capacity for oxygen, even though they don't stay under that long, like 5 or 6 minutes. Hmm. But there are some animals that capitalize on storing oxygen in their bones. I think maybe I'm getting mixed up with dinosaurs, but we'll have to check that out. But to get back to Florida, tell people about the Portuguese man of war, because that's really interesting. Remember, you saw them at Penny Camp?
We were in Key Largo. I think we were actually in a state flower park or something. I think we were just on the beach in Key Largo, and I saw, it looked actually like a piece of trash, like a plastic bag.
Right.
That had been washed up in the tide pool area. So I went and I looked at it, and some of the tentacles, I guess, were still moving around, and I took a picture of it. I didn't touch it because it's not good to touch anything that looks like a jellyfish. And it was a Portuguese man of war. So then I was reading more about them, and I learned that they're not actually jellyfish, and they're a colony of different organisms, or a colony of polyps, I guess, like the corals that you talked about for the Belize show. And that each organism has a different function. There's the top, the sail, and then there's the reproductive part, and then there's the other part that's the tentacles.
Yeah.
But they are highly toxic, so do not touch any Portuguese man of war. And I read that the toxins are 75% as toxic as a cobra's venom, and they can cause serious
pain. They're pretty nasty critters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the reason that I asked Ariana to talk about it, because if you ever go to Florida, you could find them on any of the beaches, washed up on the beaches. And even after they're dead, the nematocytes are made up of like a coiled spring with a little harpoon at the end of it. So even after they're dead, it will still react to touch.
Wow.
So you touch it, and it's going to get that harpoon out right into your skin and give you the toxin. So you have to be really careful of them. Mm-hmm. And you could probably, I think they're in Florida Bay also. So even, you know, you guys are camping at the edge of the bay there. And I don't know if it's a great place to swim.
No, and you can't even see them in the water, but you still might come in contact with them.
Yeah. And they move around. They're really part of the plankton community.
Hmm.
They're zooplankton because they can't move on their own. They go with the tides or the winds. And that big gas bag is like a sail, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're called Portuguese man of war. They look like old-time fighting ships, galleons, you know, that had these huge sails.
Hmm.
And they just drift along with the tides and the winds. So you never know. And even if you go swimming in the Florida beaches and you don't see any Portuguese man of wars at all, if you go swimming, sometimes there'll be little pieces of the tentacles that are broken up in the surf. And you could get this irritation on your skin, and you don't know what the hell it is, but it could be from them, or from some true jellyfish that have stinging cells too.
Mm.
Nasty critters.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's problems all over the place. So, and Florida's a great place to go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great place to
mm-hmm.
visit.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to add now? We have a few minutes left. Jack, how much time left do we have? 4 minutes.
Just that everyone should visit the Everglades. Not all at the same time, but if you have the opportunity, you should definitely go.
Yes, and if you folks want any information on it, you can put comments on our site and say, ask me about the good places to go, and I'll try to help you out. Even though I haven't worked there in 15 years, what's happened to the Everglades, it's gotten bigger. There used to be a section that was called the Hole in the Donut because it was parkland, and in the middle of it was still private property. But they have bought that land now and evened it off. And Jack played that song about the desperado. Is that what was it called? Mm-hmm. Desperados in the Glades or something? Well, I'll tell you a story about one of the famous desperados that lived in the 1800s, in the early 1900s. This is before it became a park, when it was still wide open, and people were farming there, actually farming on some of the mangrove islands. And you saw it, how thick those mangroves are, right? Mm-hmm. But what they did is pioneers, they came down, they cleared the land, and they picked out spots where the Indians had lived. And the Indians had cleared open sections in the middle of the islands where they farmed, because there was plenty of rain. And the soil built up over, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years of sediment. So the soil was pretty good, even though underneath it was limestone. And people came down and farmed. And there was one guy, his name was Ed Watson. And Ed Watson was infamous. He supposedly shot some of the members of the Jesse James gang.
Wow.
And probably fled into the Glades because nobody was going to look for him down there. And this is on the western side, the 10,000 Island side, along the Gulf, where you can see that it would be difficult to find somebody who was hiding out in there. So what he did was he would come into town. There was a little tiny town right near Everglades City. It was called Chokoloskee, which is a great name, Chokoloskee, Indian name. There was a little settlement there with a general store. So he would come in to get supplies there for his farm, which was on one of the rivers. And he would hire people for the harvest season to help him pick tomatoes. And I think that he may have been growing sugar cane also. I don't know, but vegetables, a lot of vegetables. So he hired these people, and they would work for him, and then they would disappear. And he would come into town, and these other people never came into town. And people would ask him, what happened to Ed? What happened to this guy? He'd say, I don't know. He just wandered off someday and all that. So after a few years, they found some bodies floating in the bay, and it was some of these people. So they realized that after they worked for him, he would kill them, just throw them in the creeks and, you know, kill them. So the town decided that they were going to confront him when he came into town to get supplies. And he always carried 2 6 guns with him and a rifle. So all the citizens of this town were armed, because everybody was armed down there, because it was wide open, you know, it was like the West, like the Wild West. And when he came into town, they confronted him and said, Ed, what happened to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? So he saw that they were all around him, you know, like in a semicircle on the shore. So he lifted up his rifle to shoot, and luckily it misfired, and then they all shot him. So nobody knows who killed him. So there was a big inquiry, and it went to the courts and all that, but they couldn't prove that anybody had killed him. They had all killed him. So that became a famous legend and story down there. And in Peter Mathiasen's book, The Killing of Mr. Watson, he tells that story. So it's an interesting book to read about that whole lifestyle on the frontier, on the pioneering days back in Florida, before it was a park. And after it became a park, in the days of the drug, there's still drug problems in the United States, but Florida, the Everglades, was a favorite place to bring drugs into the country, because motherships would be off the shore that were bringing in drugs from Central and South America, and local guys would take their small boats out and pick up the drugs and come in and store them somewhere in the Glades. And nobody knew where it was. So when I worked in Everglades City, I had a program for kids. We used to take the kids out to show them on some of the islands where the people farmed and how they lived. There were remnants of some of the cisterns from the buildings, you know, collecting rainwater, and some of the trees they had planted. So we had a thing to take the local kids out to see how people lived in the 1920s, when they had no electricity, they had no screens. Imagine living down there without screens.
Wow. Yeah.
So some of the kids that we took out had uncles and relatives that were still in jail from drug busts.
Wow.
Because
wow.
It was a major spot to bring drugs in. And just, I'll tell you one more story. I don't know. Jack, time for another short story? Okay. When I was working down there, I had a friend, and she had a boat, and we used to camp on her boat on the weekends when she had her day off and I was off. And we'd pull up into one of the creeks and, you know, anchor for the night. And one night, when we had gone asleep, we heard a powerboat coming up the creek, and she said to me, "Don't put any lights on." We had a little light on the boat, so you could see where the boat was. She said, "That's drug runners." I said, "How do you know?" She said, "Who else would be crazy enough to come up this creek in the dark with no lights on?" She said, "You'll see." And they'll come up and they'll go past us. They'll go up into the creek somewhere. And she said, "In about a half hour, they'll come back down." Sure enough, here we are. We couldn't sleep because we were waiting for the drug guns. Actually, this woman that I was friends with, she had a gun also. Everybody in Florida has guns. She had her pistol on whenever we went out on the boat. So half hour later, sure enough, she said, "Did they come back?" She said, "They won't bother us. They'll go right by and out." And sure, then that was a drug delivery. But folks, don't be discouraged to go to Florida. It's a great place to visit. You won't have any drug dealers to worry about because most of this is gone by now. And Everglades City is a really strange town to visit. It's very historic. It was built by, you remember the name of the county down there? It was Collier County.
Oh, okay.
Collier County was named after Baron Collier, this rich guy who came down to Florida, and he bought up 6,000 acres of the land around the western part. This is before the park. This was in the 1920s or something like that. And he said to the governor of the state, the county seat at that time was in Key West, and there was really no transportation to get down except by boat. So he said to the governor, "If you move the county seat up to where Everglades City is now," he says, "and if you change the name of the county to Collier County after him," he said, "I'll build the county seat in Everglades City," he said, "and I'll build a road across Florida." So the governor said, "Sure," you know, the land was, in quotes, worthless. It was, there was so much of it. So he bought up, I don't know how many thousands of acres he bought up, and he built the city of Everglades City, and he hired people to build the road across Florida, U.S. 41. It was the only road across South Florida until they built Interstate 75, probably in the 1970s or 80s. So he built a road across there. It was called the Tamiami Trail.
Yeah.
From Tampa to Miami, Tamiami Trail. That's the name of the road. And Everglades City was a company town. It was like the West with stagecoaches. And he owned all the stores in the town. He ran a trolley track down the middle of the town. Because the people, they didn't have any cars or anything or transportation. And he built the road across South Florida. And if next time you go to Florida, there's a state park called Collier Seminole State Park. It's west of Everglades City. And if you go in there, there's a national engineering historic site in the park. There's a big steam dredge that they use to build the road. Because to build the road, what they did is they dug a canal right across Florida. It's still there, that canal. You know, in Chalk Valley, across the road north, there's that canal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the canal that was dug out to get the limestone to make the elevation to build the road right next to the canal. So he brought this steam dredge in that was a walking dredge. What it could do, it could lift itself up and move ahead 10 feet, then settle down again, and then they would dig, and then it would move along. So it was famous, the walking steam dredge.
Wow.
And it's still in the park there.
Okay.
And it was made by the Bay City Dredge Company or something like that. They're still in business. I looked them up on the internet.
Wow.
So that's just a little side hill of Florida. And as I say, everybody should go. Like you said, Ariane, it's a great place to visit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do it in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And you went online and found a lot of information.
Yeah.
The park site is a good site.
Yeah, it tells you about all the programs that are going on, and you can make reservations ahead of time. And
that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anything else, Pierre, you want to add to this adventure?
No, I would say it was a great time, and wildlife viewing and very inexpensive.
Now, if you go camping, it's inexpensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're going to stay in a motel or something, there even are some reasonably priced motels. I know you said you checked the ones around...
In Homestead. We found a cheap place in Homestead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you take a look at it or you didn't?
Oh, yeah, we stayed there. And it's nice because it's close to the Keys.
How was
and it's
it?
Close.
Was it okay?
It was fine, you know.
That's good. What did they charge a night? I'm curious.
80, I think, maybe. Oh,
I guess that's cheap for the for the winter in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We fit 5 people in there.
Yeah, and that's the way to do it, right?
That's how you do it.
Make a group.
Yeah, try and head to sleep on the floor.
Did you stop at the Roberta's that I told you about?
Robert is here.
Robert is here.
Robert is here. It was great. They had lots of wonderful milkshakes, and they had maracuya, passion fruit, which I hadn't had fresh passion fruit since I left Ecuador 3 years ago, so that was very exciting for me.
Yes, that's on the road into the visitor center, right? Mm-hmm. The main road.
The Ernest Cove Visitor
Center. Yeah, it's a fruit and vegetable place, mm-hmm. and they make these great smoothies. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Every time I was in that neighborhood, I had to stop there for a key lime smoothie or something.
There.
It was a great place. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to wind it up soon. Jack, are we just about out of time? Okay, so I want to thank you folks for coming back and sharing Florida with me again. Bring back all my memories of working in Florida. So say goodbye to everybody, and we'll see you again.
Sure. It was a pleasure, Bernie.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks again for having us on.
Okay. And
there's a boat race down the river. There's a slow boat on my mind. Everybody's going like crazy. And I'm taking my own sweet time. I'll drift down the Big Shark River. Take a boat ride on the bay. Just trying to find a little peace of mind. Down in the Everglades.
Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode. So this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaways Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the green market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com.